From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The federal government's raid on marijuana clubs, the so-called war on drug, escalates. This is a war on the most vulnerable people in America.
Scenes from the drug war, from San Francisco to Tulia, Texas, to New York's Rockefeller drug laws, where it all began. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State General Colin Powell said yesterday the administration is considering a variety of options to overthrow Saddam Hussein amid indications that President Bush and his top advisors are close to settling on a plan. The New York Times is reporting the administration had reached a consensus that the Iraqi leader must be overthrown and that plans to do so are being drawn up. Meanwhile, General Powell drew a distinction between Iraq on the one hand and Iran and North Korea on the other, three countries President Bush has lumped together as a, quote, axis of evil because of their quest for weapons of mass destruction. Powell said there are no war plans against Iran and North Korea. Next month, Vice President Dick Cheney is scheduled to visit a number of nations that border Iraq, including Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Turkey. Cheney also plans to visit Britain, Egypt, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Qatar, and Oman, all of which Washington says could provide useful support in attacks against Iraq. A Turkish publisher who printed political essays by MIT professor Noam Chomsky has been acquitted by a court of producing propaganda against the unity of the Turkish state. Chomsky himself traveled to Istanbul to lend his support to Fatih Tas, who would have faced a prison sentence if found guilty. After his release, Tas credited Chomsky with contributing to his acquittal. The book, American Interventionism, investigates Turkey's violent campaign against the Kurdish minority, documenting Washington's support for systematic human rights abuses by the Turkish government. In the book, Chomsky accuses Washington of supplying the Turkish government with weapons used to perpetrate what he called intensive ethnic cleansing against the Kurds. The publisher, TASS, was charged last September. While in Turkey, Chomsky said he was willing to have his name added to the charge sheet against TASS. After being subjected to a bipartisan oral barrage from 21 senators, Ken Lay, the former chair of Enron, asserted his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination yesterday and pleaded with members of the Senate Commerce Committee not to rush to judgment about his responsibility for the largest corporate bankruptcy in U.S. history. Lay sat scowling and impassive through more than an hour of harsh senatorial criticism. During the hearing, he was compared to Charles Ponzi and compared unfavorably to a carnival barker. He was accused of running a conspiracy and gouging the energy consumers of California. He was scornfully called Kenny Boy by a senior senator and accused of using millions of dollars generated by Enron's inflated stock to try to buy a cash-and-carry government. Several of the senators questioning Lay received campaign contributions from Enron. Kenny Boy was the term George W. Bush often used to introduce him. All of this comes amid reports that the White House is working through the Republican National Committee to kill campaign finance legislation in Congress while protecting President Bush from any political fallout. The Shays-Meehan bill would ban the large unlimited political donations known as soft money. An internal target list compiled by the Republican Party identifies 33 Republicans who'd previously voted for the bill when it was unlikely to become law. These members are seen as undecided about how to vote this time and potentially available to back amendments that would ultimately weaken the legislation or kill it outright. We go now to Texas. You are joined by Andrew Wheat of Texans for Public Justice. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us. Well, let's start on Enron and the significance of Ken Lay appearing before the Senate Commerce Committee.
Well, I think if Ken Lay was not taking the Fifth Amendment and was talking freely with us today, he would be an excellent source of information on how critical the unregulated flow of special interest influence was to the formation of Enron in the first place, its rapid rise, its rapid fall. Again and again and again, the very Congress that is debating campaign finance today has passed laws to deregulate energy futures, to take the regulatory cops off the beat, to provide tax holidays for corporations like Enron, that allowed it to amass extraordinary power, as well as, I think, a kind of arrogance and hubris that led to its ultimate downfall. These gentlemen like Lay, Fastow, and Skilling truly believed that they were above the law because, in effect, they were adjunct lawmakers.
Can you talk about Enron in relation to campaign finance reform? Those who are supporting it, those who are not, those who received the big money from Enron?
Well, this whole thing is such a Machiavellian game. As you said in your intro, there are a large number of the swing votes in today's vote are from House members who had previously voted for a substantially similar piece of legislation when they were under the cover of the certainty that the Senate would not pass any legislation and that it would never become law. And so there's a vast kabuki theater going on where those who ultimately have the end game of killing any significant campaign finance law are sort of coming out of the closet, and one of the ways they're trying to kill it is contradictorily to say that they support an actually tougher bill that would put even greater limits on the use of soft money and issue ads. And the reason being that if they pass legislation that's significantly different from what the Senate has already passed last year, then it's going to force this legislation to go into a dark room behind closed doors where a House Senate conference committee can begin to gut the bill.
Andrew Weed, I want to thank you very much for being with us of Texans for Public Justice. You are listening to Democracy Now!
I am a medicine man, I have a medicine tail. I am a medicine man, I walk a medicine trail. I am a medicine man, I do a medicine dance. I am a medicine man, I sing a medicine chant. I am a medicine man, I have a medicine tail. I am a medicine man, I walk a medicine trail. I got potions that'll heal your wounds, and the rhythms that I drum will soothe. I got harmonies to give you. I'm a medicine man, healing's my plan.
Medicine Man, Bobby McFerrin here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Bush administration urged law enforcement officers and civilians to be on the highest alert in the aftermath of the FBI warning of an imminent attack against the United States, federal law enforcement agents raided medical marijuana clubs across California yesterday. Federal agents raided at least three clubs in San Francisco, Oakland, and Petaluma. According to the San Francisco Independent Media Center, they raided five other sites as well. The Oakland home of longtime cannabis activist Ed Rosenthal and the 6th Street Harm Reduction Center in San Francisco, another medical marijuana club, were among the first raids by Drug Enforcement Agency officials. Four were arrested at the center. They face between 40 years to life in prison. The Harm Reduction Center serves about 200 patients a day, all with doctors' recommendations to get the drug. Many suffer from chronic pain, from AIDS and cancer. The raids came on the very day the White House's Office of National Drug Control Policy released a new strategy in the war on drugs, aiming to reduce use of illegal drugs 25% in 5 years. The administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration, Asa Hutchinson, met a hostile audience later in the day at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco as he explained the stepped-up drug war. Protesters demonstrated outside his talk on the vision of the DEA, which he called "Let's Don't Punt" on the third down. San Francisco officials say the raid and Hutchinson's simultaneous visit were the latest insults in an ongoing battle between local and federal officials. The Supreme Court said last year it is illegal to distribute marijuana for medical purposes, but San Francisco law enforcement officials have said their job is to enforce the laws of California, where voters overwhelmingly approved the use of medical marijuana. Voters in Arizona, Alaska, California, Colorado, Maine, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington have all approved ballot initiatives allowing the use of medical marijuana. We're going to turn right now to two people who were involved with this story yesterday as the raids went down. Judy Apple of the Drug Policy Alliance speaking to us from the Bay Area, and Don Duncan with the Alliance of Berkeley Patients. Don Duncan, let's begin with you. Can you lay out exactly what happened yesterday, what time it all took place, how much notice there was, what were the police doing?
Well, good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me. The Bay Area has been sort of braced for a political impact for some time now following the Supreme Court decision last year. Now, of course, the Supreme Court did not overturn Proposition 215, as was commonly reported in the media. In fact, there was a very narrow ruling regarding the specific defendant in that case. But California's medical marijuana law is still the law of the land and is still quite valid. Yesterday morning, sometime between 6 and 8 a.m., we understand, the raids on medical cannabis businesses and residences around the area began. We understand that by about 6 a.m. or so, Ed Rosenthal was in custody at his home, and that his wife and child were being detained there at their home. And by about 10 a.m. in the morning, we know that the 6th Street Harm Reduction Center and several other businesses and homes in the area had been raided. It's not clear now exactly how many individuals were arrested. I've heard the number 4 and as many as 8 locations. But again, since this is just now occurring in the Bay Area, details are a bit sketchy at this time.
Don, can you explain what the Alliance of Berkeley Patients is?
We're a political organization that was organized by medical cannabis patients and advocates in Berkeley to defend the rights of medical cannabis patients. We realized early last year that there will be a variety of threats and efforts to roll back Proposition 215. Most recently in Berkeley, for instance, it was necessary to organize to stop a zoning measure that would have forced medical cannabis dispensaries out of town. What we're finding now, though, is that we have to link up with organizations all over the state and the country to fight this federal crackdown on medical cannabis rights and on states' rights.
Judy Apple, where do you come into this picture with the Drug Policy Alliance?
The Drug Policy Alliance is the leading national agency looking at reforming and changing national drug policies. And the reason why we are appalled by these recent raids is because we need to look at them not as isolated events, but instead as a part of a clear message that the Bush administration, in the wake of clear public sentiment saying, look, we want a change in national drug policy, we want to move away from this law enforcement approach, in the face of that very clear message throughout the country, the Bush administration is using the war on terrorism as an excuse to crank up attacks on individuals and organizations who are dispensing medicine to individuals in California under Prop 215, as well as a similar type of raids against individuals around the country.
Can you talk about the Super Bowl advertisements that aired on the most watched TV day of the year, I think it was, and how that fits into this picture? Was it laying the groundwork for the surprise raids that we saw yesterday in California?
I think what it is very consistent with this with the Bush administration's heavy-handed approach to drug policy. Instead of trying to change a failed policy that's been in place for over 30 years, they've made it very clear that what they're going to do is crank it up. And the advertisements that during the Super Bowl really were trying to link the war on terrorism. They basically send the message, if you use drugs, you're anti-American. And instead of addressing the real needs, which is to move towards a public health approach or a treatment approach, the ads in the Super Bowl, I think they set a policy foundation for what we saw yesterday in San Francisco, and to be honest with you, what I think we can expect to see as an ongoing trend throughout the country.
Don Duncan of Alliance of Berkeley Patients, can you explain further this distinction between federal law and state law and what the police are doing about it?
Well, in 1996, as you know, 70% of the California voters approved Proposition 215 that allows a doctor to make a recommendation for medical cannabis and allows a patient to use and cultivate medical cannabis for their medical needs. Now, the federal law does not recognize the medical value of cannabis. Congress has placed marijuana in Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act. What that means is that there's no accepted medical use. However, that designation has always been controversial and always been contested. What we're asking the federal government to do is to help facilitate safe and affordable access. And in fact, Representative Barney Frank has introduced a House Resolution 2592, which would require the federal government to respect local states that are trying to make a difference on this issue and protect the patients. It's very important that the local officials who are in touch with the communities and their constituencies take the lead in this issue. Here in California, there's been an unprecedented amount of cooperation between law enforcement, patients, and providers to help protect communities and to protect safe and affordable access. That kind of cooperation is what we need. We don't need this sort of a heavy-handed and highly politicized crackdown. I can tell you in California right now, the patients are terrified and they're angry. They feel betrayed by the federal government, and they feel, and justifiably so, at risk. They're afraid that their home or their business might be raided now by federal agents.
If I can just add, Amy, that it's not just California that has passed a medical marijuana bill. It's a total of nine states that have passed medical marijuana bills through initiative, and then Hawaii, in addition, that has a medical marijuana law. And the people who really suffer in these kinds of raids are the patients who no longer can access their medicine. We're not talking about that. That's what we're talking about here, is really sick people who can't get their medicine.
There's a tremendous human cost when you find that the patients are deprived of their medicine and of their basic safety. And, you know, we hear a lot now about the connection between drug use and terrorism, and that's tremendously hurtful for the legitimate patients who are patriotic citizens and want nothing more than their good health. And to be linked now with the Taliban or the Al-Qaeda is just outrageous, and it's very hurtful to the people here in California that our president and the DEA would somehow try to tie us in to terrorism and suggest that it's unpatriotic to take care of your health.
Don Duncan of the Alliance of Berkeley Patients, explain what medical marijuana does. Give me an example and how someone uses it. And then what does it mean to say that the DEA raided medical marijuana clubs? What do these clubs look like? But start with the uses of this.
Of course. Well, medical marijuana is widely used for conditions such as chemotherapy to help with the nausea associated with that. It's remarkably effective with AIDS wasting syndrome. Probably the fastest growing use for medical cannabis that we're seeing in California is for the treatment of chronic pain, where patients find that marijuana is less debilitating than narcotic alternatives. We also find that people receive relief for multiple sclerosis, in some cases for glaucoma. So there are a wide variety of conditions for which cannabis can be used. Now, the California law states that a person can use medical marijuana for any condition for which it provides relief, and it falls to the doctors to be the gatekeepers and the guardians in California and to determine where the use is appropriate and where it falls under the protection of the law. Now, in California, patients have joined together in collectives and cooperatives and established dispensaries. and they pool their resources to provide for their medical needs. Some of these dispensaries cultivate medical cannabis. In other situations, the patients cultivate the cannabis and then bring it to the dispensary so that it can be provided for all of the members. These dispensaries are not traditional businesses in the sense that most people think of them. They actually function as community centers where people can network, where they can find a social support structure, and where they can obtain their medication. These centers are an asset to our community. Not only do they protect the health of people, but they provide them a healing environment and a place to connect with other human beings and to find community and healing together. And so they're very, very important to the overall health care of the patients. They're by no means a threat to the security of the neighborhoods, and they certainly are not large-scale trafficking organizations, as Asa Hutchinson suggested yesterday in his speech.
What about that speech? Was this clearly timed, not coincidental, the DEA administrator coming to California to give a speech and hours before various places raided throughout the state?
I can't believe that was a coincidence, and it seems like a very bad timing to me. You know, Asa Hutchinson said he was here to announce a new strategy in the drug war, but what we find is it's just the same old lies. We know that you can't penalize people for their personal behavior, that criminalizing responsible adults is a failed policy. And we know that in most other countries, the leaders of those nations are moving towards acceptance of medical marijuana, including Canada, just to our north, where there is now a national law legalizing the medical use of cannabis.
Judy Apple, were you there last night when Asa Hutchinson gave a speech?
I was personally not there. I did speak with some people in our organization who were at the speech.
What did they say?
Well, you know, it seems that although I understand that Asa Hutchinson talked about the raids and said that that wasn't going to be a priority, we really need to look at the DEA's priorities right now and look at where they're choosing to spend their money at a time when we are supposedly in the most heightened national state of emergency or state of security, and the government is spending its time spending its law enforcement resources going towards raiding facilities that offer the medication to very sick people. And my understanding is that Asa Hutchinson didn't respond to those questions last night adequately.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Don Duncan, Alliance of Berkeley Patients, Judy Apple of the Drug Policy Alliance. Again, yesterday, the DEA swooped down on medical marijuana clubs around California, raided them, and arrested some of those who were involved with them. And after our break, we're going to go from California to the tiny town of Tulia, Texas. 2 years ago, 43 people were arrested on charges of selling small amounts of cocaine in the biggest drug sting in local history there. More than 10% of the African-American community of the town of 5,000 were arrested in the sting, conducted by a single undercover officer with no corroborating evidence. In some cases, hometown juries later meted out sentences ranging from 20 to more than 300 years. In Tulia, set on the high plains of the Texas Panhandle, local officials declared the operation a stunning success. In all, 22 people were sent to prison. Others received probation. The undercover agent at the center of the operation was even named by the state as a lawman of the year. The man, Tom Coleman, based the raid on claims like resident Billy Wafer, a forklift driver, sold him cocaine at a local convenience store. But Wafer's employer testified he was at work at the time. This agent said the drug deal took place. The question was this operation, once hailed as a victory in the war on drugs, actually a war on African Americans? In October of 2000, relatives of those indicted joined the ACLU and the NAACP and the William Moses Kuntzler Fund for Racial Justice to file a formal complaint with the Department of Justice against the Panhandle Regional Narcotics Task Force, the controlling agency in charge of the drug sting. Just after this music break, we turn to a film that was done about Tulia, Texas, created by the Kunstler Fund, by Emily and Sarah Kunstler. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to Tulia, Texas, scenes from a drug war.
1920 and now, is they can't take us out and hang us on a tree. They can just send us to prison for life. It's the same thing. We ain't gonna never be free again. We all gonna die.
In the last two decades, the war on drugs has become a principal excuse for locking up tons and tons of black and brown people.
Deborah Small of the Linda Smith Center.
They call that racial profiling, and they do that everywhere. So why is it you got so many black folks getting locked up? Because we're the only ones they're looking for.
LaWanda Smith will be coming up next.
In the spring of 1998, Sheriff Larry Stort decided to investigate the drug scene in Tulia, a small town in the Texas Panhandle. Using funds from a regional drug task force, the sheriff hired an undercover agent named Tom Coleman to conduct a covert sting operation. Early on the morning of July 23, 1999, the arrests finally came. Even Sheriff Stort was unprepared for his agent's success. In 18 months, Coleman had allegedly made more than 100 controlled buys of powdered cocaine. As the images of suspects appeared on the evening news, it was clear that those caught in the sting had something in common. 39 of the 46 arrested came from Tulia's tiny black community, which numbers less than 350. More than 10% of the town's black population had been taken down on the word of one man.
They arrested us at 7 in the morning.
LaWanda Smith.
Honest to goodness, by 12:01, they came with eviction notices. I mean, there was 13 women in a cell together, and we all received these eviction notices at the same time. If that's not conspiracy for something, then what is? We hadn't even been completely booked in. We hadn't even got our bond, you know, sentencing or anything before we got eviction notices. And, you know, we were thinking, the ladies that were locked up, you know, they had children. What were they gonna do? How were they gonna get their stuff moved out of the house and everything? I mean, it was just one hard day that day. I mean, everything was taken away in one swoop, thanks to Tom Coleman.
Billy Wafer was arrested in the drug sting.
Yes, those people are in prison based solely on the word of Tom Coleman's. It was their word against Tom Coleman's word. And actually, some of those defendants had witnesses to say that they was elsewhere. And still yet, they was convicted, you know, based solely on Tom Coleman's word.
Since the arrests, Agent Coleman's credibility has come under fire. Coleman was dismissed from his previous law enforcement position for embezzlement. While working undercover in Tulia, Coleman did not wear a wire during any of the alleged transactions. No video surveillance tapes were made, and no second officer was used to corroborate his reports. Instead, Coleman recorded names, dates, and other details of the transactions by writing them on his leg.
Randy Credico of the Kunstler Fund.
Well, it looks like there's only one person using powder cocaine in that city, and that was Tom Coleman, because he was the only one supposedly buying. People were not buying drugs from the black community there.
While surprise search warrants were served at dawn on the alleged dealers, not one of the raids turned up drugs, weapons, or significant amounts of cash.
If there were that many drug dealers here, I just wondered why I couldn't ever borrow any money from anybody. I mean, No one had any money. Nobody had bank accounts. Nobody owned a home. Nobody owned a car. Cars were repossessed.
Again, LaWanda Smith.
I mean, nobody owned anything, you know? And for them to say that was many drug dealers here, and for Tom Coleman to spend as much money as he had here, you know, you'd think they'd have found some of that money, you know, or found some of the merchandise that was bought with that money. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing.
It's like having six Santa Clauses in a city of 20 people. You know, you don't need 46 drug dealers. There's no way they could all survive off the drug trade in a city that small.
Images of the early morning bust appeared on local television news. In the days following the arrests, the names and addresses of the defendants were published in the Tulia Herald, branding them as dealers before they were tried. Gary Gardner, a farmer who lives in nearby Vigo Park, became an advocate for the defendants because he thought the media coverage of the bust would bias potential jurors and keep the accused from receiving a fair trial.
I initially got into it because of a lot of the statements Larry Stewart, the undercover agent, and McEachin made that I thought were prejudicial. Plus, the way that they drug these people in front of the cameras. I guarantee you, if you drug my wife in front of the camera at daylight without letting her comb her hair, she's going to come across not a pretty person, although she's one of the prettiest women I know. And they had facilities up there to protect the dignity of these people. They have a garage up there at the jail they could have drove these cars in and unloaded these prisoners and booked them without doing that embarrassing number. So they had to have done that deliberately. And the only reason I could think of to do it was to influence the people in town that these people were guilty.
Less than 5% of Tulia is African American, a fact that made it unlikely the black community would be represented on the jury.
I don't consider anyone I'm convicted yet. I don't care if they have had 11, 10, 15 trials, because they haven't had a fair trial in front of an impartial group of their peers, and until they do, in my books, they're not convicted. They're just being held illegally.
More than half of the defendants pled not guilty and went to trial. Many were sent to prison, their sentences ranging from 20 to more than 300 years.
Maddie White, mother of three
defendants.
But
I told myself, if you didn't do it, you stand firm, and, you know, whatever they say, there's something to come out of this. And we didn't know that this was going to happen, you know. We were just saying, oh, you're going to be okay. You'll retrial, you'll get out of this.
Freddie Brookins, Sr. is father of another of the defendants.
Well, Freddie come to me and told me they offered him a plea bargain. They wanted him to plead for 5 years. So he asked me, what did I think about it? And I told him that, I said, you didn't do it, did you? He told me, no. I said, well, if you didn't do the crime, then you stand to be right. If it cost you 100 years, then you take the 100 years. You stand to be right. And that's why Freddie didn't take a plea bargain. That's why he went to trial.
Freddie was sentenced to 25 years.
Joe Moore, the first defendant tried, was described by District Attorney Terry McEachin as one of Tulia's major drug dealers. At 67 years old, Joe Moore, a hog farmer, was the oldest defendant. He was sentenced to 99 years for two counts of cocaine delivery.
This house here is where Joe Moore lived. He's the man Mr. McEachin called the kingpin of the Tulia drug dealers.
Thelma Johnson, friend of Joe
Moore.
He
was made out to be the horriblest, baddest person, you know, in the world. The kingpin, the top man, or whatever.
He never owned any expensive vehicles, any expensive toys, or any expensive house. If he ever made any money dealing dope, he still got it, because he damn sure didn't spend it.
In Joe Moore's case, it was used as an example to the rest of the blacks. You plead or you go down for life.
That's mainly why I took the plea bargain. I was scared. I wanted to see my family. I had seen how much time they gave other people. I figured they'd do the same to me, which they would. I ain't no different from them. We all black.
Jared Irvine, arrested.
The conviction of so many black citizens, most of them under the age of 30, has brought racial tensions in this small town to a head. Many believe that the sting selectively targeted young people who had ties across racial lines. Those whites who were arrested in the bust all had romantic relationships with blacks.
That sends a message, don't mess with black people.
Reverend Waters.
And if you're black, don't mess with whites. And why is that? I read a paper the other day, it said that we sit together, we drink together, we go to funerals together, we go to church together. Do you see that since you've been here?
It really haven't changed because they was doing this when I was a little girl.
Maddie White.
When we had to go through the back door to get hamburgers or whatever, you know. I remember all that stuff. So I guess it's trying to get back like that. I don't know what it is.
When I moved here, I moved my kids away from the violence of Fort Worth. And I exposed them to racism, poverty, and somewhat some people that are bigots. And which is the lesser of the evils?
Prejudice or violence.
That's pretty bad. Now, when we lived in Fort Worth, I never had my kids coming home, Daddy, they called me a nigger at school. Never had that. And the teacher and the principal say, oh, you've never had this happen to you before?
It's no future for them here, the young black people. You're wonderful as long as you're winning our football games, our basketball game. You know, I'll buy you track shoes, I'll help you get clothes, I'll help you do anything. I'll help you go to the game if your mother can't afford it. And don't even think about moving out of this town if, you know, because we want that sports. We come together on sports. Now, that's about the only thing that I've seen that can bring two of you together.
Like, most
Monica
of the
Brown
boys
and
they got
Williams.
Were athletes, and now in high school.
And yeah. They junior high, and now they're arresting them. But as long as they was on the football team winning their games, they wouldn't care. On their track team running their race, run, boy, run. They wouldn't have cared. But now when they graduated, oh, we ain't gonna worry about them no more. We can't help them no more.
Just every two or three years, every time a young individual graduates that happens to be black, if that individual is a star athlete, they will, for some reason, that individual ends up in prison here. They graduate from high school, they get their PhD in the prison. Prison house diploma.
Reverend Evan
That's
Waters
where
of
go
the Church of
from
Christ.
If they stay here, they go to prison. If they leave, maybe they can do something
we
different.
We got our kids away from here. As soon as they graduate, they were out here.
Jocelyn
it
Waters.
It was just that simple.
We don't even want them coming home.
Mm-mm. Don't even come home.
Because the sting sent so many young parents to prison, friends and family have taken on the responsibility of raising the children they left behind.
Maddie White.
The main reason I pled out is because if I wouldn't have, I know I was probably going to do get at least 25 max. I mean, nothing less. And the second reason I pled out is because my friend Michelle Williams, she had gone like a week prior to that and got sentenced, you know, and her kids were here and I had someone to take care of my kids if I were to go, but who was going to take care of hers? And I just didn't want to leave them, you know, hanging out there to dry. So that's one of the reasons I took the plea, is for the kids.
And the kids, they just cry and cry. You know, they wake up at night, they want their mama, and they cry and cry and cry. Or in the morning time, they wake up, and they want their mama and their dad, and they cry and cry and cry. And sometimes I'm here by myself, and then I think about them, and then I'm crying. So, you know, it's pretty rough. And it's not only me. I think a lot of the families, they just, when they by themselves, they probably just cry, and they just wonder, you know, why this happened like this.
Black families in Tulia have begun to organize in response to the arrests and have traveled across Texas to bring national media attention to the story, raising questions about the way the state's drug task forces conduct investigations. The indictment against Billy Wafer was dismissed because his lawyer was able to present witnesses and time cards that confirmed that Mr. Wafer was at work the time the deal was alleged to have happened. Mr. Wafer's lawyers have filed a suit against Tom Coleman and Sheriff Stewart, alleging that they conspired to eliminate blacks from Tulia by manufacturing evidence in the drug sting.
I'm happy to extend. I'm not elite about it because our goal was to get those that was in prison out, and yet I proved my innocence. They're still sitting in prison, so I'm not going to really be completely fulfilled until we complete the mission. The mission is to get those that's in prison out, and you know, for them to prove they're innocent too. And once we do that, I'll be very happy.
That was Billy Wafer.
Charles Kiker, a retired pastor, lives in Tulia. Kiker, along with other Tulia residents, both black and white, have come together to form a group called Friends of Justice, which is working to overturn the convictions.
We're still hoping. Maybe it's hoping against hope, but we're still hoping that the injustice of the trial, the injustice not just of the trials, but of the entire sting can be brought to light, and that somewhere down the road, all of the trials will be thrown out. Even if that means that some people who were possibly guilty of dealing drugs are released as well, because the sting in itself was so poorly done, so illegally done, that the whole thing just should be thrown out.
A little town like Tulia, why do we have federal money for undercover? We have an undercover in here all the time.
This
trying
is Nancy
to,
Bean.
Basically, the way I see it is seduce young people.
Mm-hmm.
That's their job, is seduction. Anyway, I'm afraid for my children, and I'm afraid for everyone's children because of this mindset of catching people, of catching them and punishing them. It's frightening, and it's wrong.
I think this is how the drug war has been fought across the country.
Billy Wafer.
Since I've been doing some studying on, you know, task forces and how they work, I see that it's a number thing to the biggest part of them. And to get their grants from the government, they have to show progress. And it just seems to be all across the country that blacks are the more that they can, you know, more easy to make the cases on than any other race. So, you know, I believe that's just the way they're going to fight the drug wars until we do something about it.
What's happening here in Tulia is a microcosm of what can happen nationally.
Deborah Small.
And you all are at the epicenter, of an epidemic of law enforcement inequity and excesses that are national in scope. And that what you do here as a community in terms of organizing, fighting for your rights, and being vocal and reclaiming those family members who've been taken away from you will be a model for black and brown communities throughout the U.S. Everything that you need to prevail in this struggle is right here in this room, and it's right here in this town. And all it takes is for you all to be committed, to be clear about what your commitment is, to remain in action, and to stay motivated by love. And I believe that ultimately you will win, because love always wins.
I'm going to stand until I can't stand no more, if I have to stand by myself. And I don't feel like I'll have to stand by myself, because there's too many other people, you know, is involved in this.
Maddie White, three caught in the sting, were her children. On October 21st, 2000, Tulia residents joined forces in battle for their future. May 2001, the ACLU's Tulia's bills ban racial profiling and drug policy enforcement and require corroboration for undercover agents and informants. Further action is planned. You are listening to Democracy Now! That was Tulia, Texas, Scenes from the Drug War, produced by Sarah and Emily Kunstler for the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. We'll be back in a minute. We're Going Wrong, Rotary Connection featuring Minnie Riperton here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. A powerful documentary about Tulia, Texas, beginning the program with the raids in San Francisco. We're going to turn now to two guests, one on the phone, one in the studio. Randy Credico, who was one of those interviewed in the documentary, is with the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Jeff Blackburn joins us on the telephone from Texas, attorney for a number of those arrested in Tulia. Jeff, can you start off by just telling us the latest? It's now 2002. We're talking about more than 10% of the black population of this small town being arrested in one fell swoop. At this point, what are the numbers of people in jail and out, and what does Tulia look like?
Well, Tulia is still largely devastated. The population itself, the black community, is permanently altered by the numbers of people that are still in jail serving large, large sentences. It's one thing to say that they managed to take out 10% of the population, but when you really look at the impact of it, you're talking about the male breadwinners of that population. So you're looking at a lot of real bad collateral damage being done to the community as a whole, just in terms of children that don't get fed very well or clothed very well, people that are getting taken care of through relatives and so forth. So the town itself is, the black community in the town of Tulia has really been hit by an atom bomb by virtue of this. So far, we've got, and it's sort of, I know that we got one person out who just came out on parole very recently, Donnie White, one of the first people to fall in this thing. But we're still dealing with a solid number of about, I think, 14 to 16 people that are either in jail or in prison right now, incarcerated in one form or another as a result of this, either through parole revocations and so forth. And then the numbers get worse when you look at people that are under the thumb of the state by virtue of being on probation and having to report to authorities regularly. The real focus for us right now is two trials that have yet to be conducted in all of these cases. These are two women. Tanya White, which is Maddie White's daughter. I think the listeners heard from Maddie earlier in the documentary. And a young lady named Zuri Bossett. Now, these two women were, lucky for them, not around in Tulia when the arrests came. So they didn't get to go through the mill of court-appointed lawyers and quick convictions that the rest of them did. By virtue of being gone, they were able to get their cases tried now. So that's what's coming up. And that's what all of our efforts down here in Texas through our organization called the Tulia Legal Defense Project is being focused on.
Randy Credico, this case got a good deal of national attention, the Tulia, Texas case. In fact, I think some network news magazines ran a piece on the large number of African Americans who were arrested. How did it get this kind of attention? This is happening all over the United States.
Well, it got this kind of attention. First of all, Nate Blakeslee wrote an article in the Texas Observer 3 or 4 months before we found out about it. We got a letter from the Reverend there, and we got the Reverend on a local station here, WBAI.
This was Reverend Waters?
Reverend Kiker. And we got a couple of defendants on wake-up call with Bernard White, the flagship station for the Pacifica Network. And then they got on your show. And once they were on Democracy Now!, I think early October of 2000, that got everyone interested. We got calls from Dateline, got calls from 60 Minutes, got calls from 2020. Everyone wanted to do the story, but it all started here. It just so happens that all of these producers from these various magazine shows listened to your show. And I mean, it was such a great deal that you did here. Not only did it get great publicity, but we raised a lot of money for the 2-Year 46 Fund, which is administered out of Jeff's office in Amarillo. But this stuff is going on throughout the state. I was just there investigating a situation in the southeast, the southeast Texas area, where these narcotics task forces are even worse. A city called Caldwell and Bryan County and Chambers County. What happened in Dallas with the 58 Mexican Americans who were framed on drug charges recently? I mean, this goes on. That's why you have 200,000 people in jail in Texas. This is just a microcosm, as Ms. Small from the Drug Policy Alliance, no longer the Lynn Smith Center, indicated. This is going on nationally in Texas. Texas has a prison growth rate population 7 times larger than China and three and a half times larger than the United States. So, and they're using these vehicles, these drug task forces, which are throughout the state, which are funded with DEA money, to basically shanghai African Americans. They're 19-1 more likely to go to prison.
This person, Tom Coleman, who was the agent who allegedly caught all these people buying and selling drugs, but had no tape, no wire, no actually concrete evidence.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, that's true. That happens everywhere. I mean, it happens every day in Manhattan Supreme Court and Queens County Supreme Court, just that this guy had such a bad background. You know, he was wanted in a different county. He continued working after this sting, even though he was arrested by the sheriff. The sheriff, Stewart, had to arrest him midway through the investigation because he had embezzled money from, I believe, Burke County or Cochran County, which is in southeastern Texas. The man has a very shady past. He was just let go from another job, I think, a couple of weeks ago. But he continued working and continued this kind of operation. He got the Man of the Year by the Department of Public Safety in Texas. But, you know, the kind of power that an individual like that has to write it down on his leg and to be able – I mean, these are legal lynchings.
What do you mean, write it down on his leg?
Write down the information. When he made so-called drug buys, these 125 purchases over a year and a half period of time – he would write the information like he did not have a recorder, did not have any surveillance, didn't have any corroboration. He would just write it down on his leg and then supposedly go to Amarillo and log in the drugs that he supposedly bought. Problem is that there's no powder cocaine, which was not pointed out here, in Tuya. Some of these guys were using crack. I mean, there's no question about it. Some of these guys were using crack in Tuya. But like Donnie White, who he was in a drug rehab center for 6 months. He got out, and then he found out he was arrested. But what no one was able to afford powder cocaine except for rich people in that city. In fact, there was the guy who owned the cattle barn where everyone worked, a guy by the name of Charles Sturgis. He was caught with 100 grams of cocaine recently. He's the guy who owned that big cattle barn, and he committed suicide a few months later.
You're talking about sentences of people who are caught or who Tom Coleman alleged who were buying or selling with sentences up to 300 years.
Yes. One guy got 325 years. Others got, like Joe Moore, got 99 years.
Joe Moore was the hog farmer.
He was the hog farmer.
Jeff Blackburn, how does this fit into sentencing in the rest of Texas and the rest of the country?
Well, you know, the tragedy of Tuya, really, the thing that makes it remarkable is that it's not remarkable. In this state, and I'm convinced a lot of other states, I mean, what we're seeing happening is any state that is going to allow rules like even New York has with three strikes, you're out, or any of these monstrous sort of automatic sentencing schemes, where if you've either had a prior conviction or if you have a certain amount or the amount that you sold is in front of a school. This was one of the gimmicks used by Coleman, incidentally, was to say that they sold most of the crack and cocaine in front of school ground equipment or playground equipment. When you turn sentencing into a bunch of gimmickry like that, you wind up with these outrageously high sentences. Tuya is not remarkable or extraordinary in that respect. This is happening all over the state and in other states where they allow this kind of sentencing to be done.
Well, speaking of all over the country. We started off the program by talking about scenes from the drug war, from the raids in San Francisco yesterday to Tulsa, Texas, to right here where it all began in New York with the Rockefeller drug laws. In the last few weeks, Randy, with the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice and Grandpa Al Lewis, Grandpa from the Munsters, as well as a number of people who call themselves the mothers of the disappeared, people who have children in the New York prison system, went up to Albany and protested outside of Governor George Pataki's State of the State address. What about it beginning here, the Rockefeller drug laws, what they are, how they started?
Okay, the modern-day war on drugs was actually begun by Nixon, but the mandatory minimum sentencing began in 1973, May 8, 1973. Governor Rockefeller used it as a ruse, basically it was a cheap political gimmick to get this look of a, you know, like he was a conservative, like he's a liberal Republican. He had this, you know, reputation of being a liberal Republican. These laws went into effect in 1973. At that time, there were 10,000 people in prison in the state of New York. Now there are 71,000 people. So it's gone up sevenfold in the last 29 years. And they use the same kind of techniques here, law enforcement-wise, as they do in Texas. It's not three strikes and you're out in the state of New York. You get mandatory minimum sentences of 15 up to 25 years in life for possession of 4 ounces of a narcotic, of any narcotic exception of marijuana, or the sale of over 2 ounces. A $10 bag. If a cop says he saw you trying to make a sale of a dollar bag of cocaine, that can get you 8 1/3 to 25 years. And believe me, that's what happens. It happens all over this state. It happens in Queens County. It happens upstate in Columbia County. It happens in Erie County.
I went with you to Bedford Hills, the women's prison, where women were serving sentences of 25 to life for being in a car with someone who had drugs.
That happens. I mean, I've seen 5 or 6 people in a room. If there are 5, 6, 10 people in a room with 4 ounces of cocaine, everyone is guilty of possession. That's an A1 felony, as if they all killed the same person.
We only have 50 seconds. Yeah. Are you making any progress? George Pataki has made sounds about overhauling the drug laws.
The district attorneys have too much power. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. And that's what's happened. The district attorneys, 99% whom are white in this state, are the ones who are controlling the issue, keeping it from being. Everyone wants reform. The governor mentioned it in a State of the State address, got more applause than anything, with the exception of mentioning Rudy Giuliani in the beginning. The district attorneys have the sway, even though 95% of the people going to prison under these laws are black and Latino. 95%, it's an astounding number. In this state, this, you know, the great state of New York, Empire State, we call it the Empire Prison State, and the conditions.
Yet more than half of the people who use drugs are not people
70%
of color.
Studies show 70% of all people who use and sell drugs are white, but 95% of those in prison in this state on drug charges are black and Latino. It's outrageous. He's right now catering to the Latino vote, and most of the organizing will be in the Latino community, because they should not, just because he goes to Vieques, they should not think that he's a friend of Latinos. Dominicans and Puerto Ricans are filling up our prisons, and he doesn't care.
If people want to get information, what is a website you would recommend that they go to?
There's the Kunstler Fund.
10 seconds.
Kunstler Fund, we have a lot of links, www.kunstler.org or drugpolicy.org, www.drugpolicy.org.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Randy Credico of the William Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, with Lizzie Ratner and Jeremy Scahill. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Our website, we'll show you the contacts, is www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!